A percept, then, is not something finished or closed off. It is one side of the total reality. The other side is the concept. The act of knowing, cognition, is the synthesis of percept and concept. Only percept and concept together make up the whole thing. The preceding discussion demonstrates that it is meaningless to look for any common element among the world's individual entities other than the conceptual content presented by thinking. Any attempt to find a world unity other than this self-consistent conceptual content, which we gain by thinking contemplation of our percepts, must fail. For us, neither a human, personal God, nor force, nor matter, nor even the idea-less will, Schopenhauer, can be considered the universal element of the world. All these entities belong merely to a limited area of our observation. We perceive a humanly limited personality only in ourselves, force and matter only in external things. As for the will, it can be seen only as an expression of our limited personality's activity. Schopenhauer wants to avoid making abstract thinking the bearer of the universal world element, and instead seeks something that presents itself to him immediately as real. This philosopher believes that we misjudge the world if we see it as external. Here's a long quote from Schopenhauer's book, The World as Will and Representation. Indeed, the sought-after significance of the world confronting me merely as my mental picture, or the transition from it as a mere mental picture of the cognizing subject to what it may be beyond to... Let me read that again. Indeed, the sought-after significance of the world confronting me merely as my mental picture, or the transition from it as a mere mental picture of the cognizing subject to what it may be beyond this, would never be discoverable if the investigator himself were nothing other than the purely cognizing subject, parenthesis, a winged cherub without a body, quote, parenthesis, but he too is rooted in that world, finds himself within it as an individual. That is, his cognition, which supports and determines the whole world as mental picture, is mediated throughout by a body whose affections are, as shown above, the intellect's starting point for contemplation of that world. For the purely cognizing subject as such, this body is a mental picture like any other, an object among objects. Its movements, its actions are known to him no differently from the changes in all other observable objects, and would be just as strange and incomprehensible to him if their meaning were not deciphered for him in a completely different way. For the subject of cognizing, which appears as an individual through its identity with the body, this body is given in two quite distinct ways, first as mental picture for the intellect's contemplation, as object among objects, and subject to their laws, but at the same time in a quite different way, namely as that which is known immediately to everyone by the word will. Every true act of his will is instantly and unfailingly a movement of his body as well. He cannot really will the act without at the same time perceiving that it appears as movement of the body. The act of will and the action of the body are not two different, objectively known states, linked by the tie of causality. Their relationship is not one of cause and effect. Rather, they are one and the same thing, but given in two altogether different ways, once quite immediately and once for the intellect's contemplation. End of long quote. With this analysis, Schopenhauer feels justified in locating the quote-unquote objectivity of the will in the body. He believes that one can feel a reality, the thing in itself in concreto, immediately in the actions of the body. Against this analysis, we must point out that the actions of our body only come to our awareness through self-percepts, and as such have no advantage over other percepts. If we wish to know their essence, then we can only do so through thinking observation, that is, by organizing them within the conceptual system of our concepts and ideas. The view that thinking is abstract, without any concrete content, that it offers at most a conceptual mirror, image of world unity, but not this unity itself, is very deeply rooted in naive human consciousness. Whoever believes this has never become clear about what a percept without a concept really is. Let us consider the world of percepts by itself. It appears as a mere juxtaposition in space, a mere succession in time, an aggregate of unconnected details. None of the things that enter and exit from the perceptual stage appears to have anything to do with any other. In the world of percepts, considered by itself, the world is a multiplicity of uniform objects. None plays a greater role than any other in the hurly-burly of the world. If we are to have the insight that this or that fact has greater significance than another, then we must consult our thinking. Without the function of thinking, a rudimentary organ that is without significance for an animal's life appears equal in value with the most important limb of its body. The separate facts emerge in all their significance, both in themselves and for everything else, only when thinking weaves its threads from entity to entity. This activity of thinking is full of content. It is only through a very specific, concrete content that I can know why a snail stands at a lower level of development than a lion. The mere sight, the percept, gives me no content that could inform me about any relative perfection in their organization. Thinking brings this content to the percept out of the human being's world of concepts and ideas. In contrast to perceptual content, which is given us from without, thought content appears within. We shall call the form in which thought content first arises intuition. Intuition is to thinking as observation is to perception. Let me say that again. Intuition is to thinking as observation is to perception. Intuition and observation are the sources of our knowledge. We remain alienated from an object we have observed in the world as long as we do not have within us the corresponding intuition, which supplies us with the piece of reality missing from the percept. Full reality remains closed off to anyone without the ability to find intuitions corresponding to things. Just as a colorblind person sees only shades of brilliance without hue, so a person without intuition observes only unconnected perceptual fragments. To explain a thing, to make it comprehensible, means nothing other than to place it within the context from which it has been torn by the arrangement of our organization described above. There is no such thing as an object cut off from the world as a whole. All separation has merely a subjective validity for us, for the way we are organized. For us, the whole world splits into above and below, before and after, cause and effect, object and mental picture, matter and force, object and subject, and so forth. What meets us in observation as separate details is linked item by item through the coherent unitary world of our intuitions. Through thinking, we join together into one everything that we separated through perceiving. Let me say it again. Through thinking, we join together into one everything that we separated through perceiving. The enigmatic quality of an object lies in its separate existence. But this separate existence is called forth by us and can, within the conceptual world, be dispelled and returned to unity again. Nothing is given to us directly except through thinking and perceiving. The question now arises, quote, what is the significance of the percept according to the reasoning here? Unquote. We have, to be sure, recognized that critical idealism's proof of the subjective nature of percepts collapses in itself. But insight into the incorrectness of the proof does not yet confirm the doctrine itself is based on error. Critical idealism's proof does not proceed from the absolute nature of thinking. Rather, it is based on the fact that naive realism, if followed consistently, cancels itself out. But how do things stand if the absoluteness of thinking is recognized? Let us suppose that a specific percept, for example red, appears in my consciousness. On continued investigation, this percept proves to be linked with other percepts, for example to a specific form and to certain percepts of temperature and touch. I call this combination, quote, an object in the sense world, unquote. I can now ask myself what else is located in that section of space where these percepts appear to me aside from what has been listed so far. I find mechanical, chemical, and other processes within that part of space. Going further, I investigate the processes that I find on the path from the object to my sense organs. I find processes of motion in an elastic medium that by their nature have nothing in common with the original percepts. If I investigate the further mediation occurring between the sense organs and the brain, I obtain the same result. I form new percepts in each of these areas, but what weaves through all of these spatially and temporally disparate percepts as the unifying medium is thinking. The vibrations of the air that mediate sound are given to me as percepts in exactly the same way as the sound itself. Thinking alone links all such percepts to one another and shows them in their mutual relationships. Other than what is immediately perceived, we cannot speak of there being anything except what is known through the conceptual connections between the percepts, connections that are accessible to thinking. Therefore, my relationship between perceived objects and perceived subjects that goes beyond what is merely perceived is purely ideal. That is, it is expressible only through concepts. Only if I could perceive how the percept of an object affects the percept of the subject, or conversely, only if I could observe the construction of a perceptual form by the subject, would it be possible to speak like modern physiology and the critical idealism built upon it. This view confuses an ideal relation of the object to the subject with a process that could only be spoken of if it were perceived. Therefore the phrase, quote, no color without a color-sensing eye, EYE, end quote, cannot mean that the eye produces color, but only that a conceptual connection, knowable through thinking, exists between the percept color and the percept eye, EYE. Empirical science will have to ascertain how the qualities of the eye and those of color relate to one another, and how the organ of sight transmits the perception of colors, etc. I can track how one percept follows another and how it stands in spatial relation to others. I can then bring this to conceptual expression. But I cannot perceive how a percept proceeds out of the unperceivable. All efforts to seek other than conceptual relations between percepts must necessarily fail. What then is a percept? Asked in this general way, the question is absurd. A percept always appears as a quite specific concrete content. This content is immediately given and is limited to what is given. Of what is given, we can ask only what it is apart. Of what is given, we can ask only what it is apart from perception, that is, what it is for thinking. Therefore, the question of what a percept is can aim only at the conceptual intuition corresponding to it. From this perspective, the question of the subjectivity of the percept, in the sense meant by critical idealism, cannot be raised at all. Only what is perceived as belonging to the subject can be characterized as subjective. The link between the subjective and the objective is not built by any real process in the naive sense, that is, by any perceptible event. It is built by thinking alone. For this reason, what seems to lie outside the perceived subject is objective for us. The percept of myself as subject remains perceivable for me when the table now before me has vanished from my observational field. But observation of the table has evoked in me an alteration that also remains. I retain the capacity to create an image of the table again later. This capacity to produce an image remains united with me. Psychology calls this image a memory picture. Yet it is the only thing that can properly be called the mental picture of the table, for it corresponds to the perceptible alteration in my own state through the presence of the table in my field of sight. It does not, in fact, signify a change in some quote-unquote I in itself, capital I, standing behind the perceived subject, but rather a change in the perceptible subject itself. The mental picture is thus a subjective percept, in contrast to the objective percept of a thing lying within the perceptual horizon. The confusion of subjective percepts with objective percepts leads in idealism to the misunderstanding that the world is my mental picture. We must now define the concept of mental picture more narrowly. What we have put forward about it so far is not its concept, but merely points the way toward finding the mental picture within our perceptual field. The exact concept of the mental picture will then make it possible for us also to achieve a satisfactory understanding of the relationship between the mental picture and its object. This will also lead us over the boundary where the relationship between the human subject and the object belonging to the world is brought down from the purely conceptual field of cognition into concrete individual life. Once we know what to make of the world, it will be easy for us to behave accordingly. We can act with our full strength only when we know the object belonging to the world to which we are devoting our activity. It's the end of the chapter. This is Addendum to the New Edition, 1918. The view characterized here can be regarded as one to which at first we are driven quite naturally when we begin to reflect on our relationship to the world. But we then see ourselves entangled in a thought structure that dissolves itself as we build it. This thought structure is such that it requires more than merely theoretical refutation. It must be lived through so as to find a way out through insight into the error to which it leads. It must appear in any discussion of the relationship between human beings and the world, not because we wish to refute others whom we believe have an incorrect view of this relationship, but because we realize what confusion any initial reflection on such a relationship can bring. The insight we must achieve is of how in such reflections we can refute ourselves. The preceding discussion was meant from just such a point of view. Anyone who wishes to work out a view of the relationship of human beings to the world becomes aware that we ourselves produce at least a part of this relationship through making mental pictures of the things and processes in the world. Our attention is therefore withdrawn from what is outside in the world and turned toward our inner world. We can begin by reflecting that we cannot have a connection to a thing or person if a mental picture does not arise within us. From this, it is but a step to the realization that, after all, we experience only our mental pictures. We know of a world outside ourselves only to the extent that it is a mental picture within us. And with this, the naive attitude toward reality, taken up before any reflection on our relation to the world, is abandoned. From a naive standpoint, we believe that we are dealing with real things. Self-reflection drives us from this point of view. It does not allow us to look at a reality such as naive consciousness believes it has before it. Such self-reflection allows us to look only at our mental pictures. These insert themselves between our own being and a supposedly real world of the kind that the naive standpoint imagines it can assert. Because of the intervening mental pictures, we can no longer look upon such a reality. We must assume that we are blind for that reality. Thus the thought of a thing in itself that is unattainable to a cognition arises. Indeed, as long as we continue to focus on the relationship to the world that we enter through the life of mental pictures, we shall never escape this thought construction. Unless we wish to close off the urge for knowledge artificially, we cannot remain at the viewpoint of naive reality. The very existence of this urge for knowledge of the relation between human beings and the world shows us that this naive standpoint must be abandoned. If the naive standpoint gave us something that could be recognized as truth, then we would not feel this urge. Yet we do not arrive at something which could be seen as truth merely by abandoning the naive standpoint, while at the same time, without noticing it, retaining the style of thought that it requires. We fall into this kind of error when we think that we experience only mental pictures, that though we believe we are dealing with realities, we are in fact conscious only of our mental pictures of realities, and therefore suppose true realities to lie beyond the scope of our consciousness as things in themselves, of which we know nothing directly and which somehow approach and influence us, with the result that a world of mental pictures comes to life within us. Those who think in this way only add another world, in thought, to the world lying before them. But with regard to this world, they really have to begin at the beginning again, for they do not think about the unknown thing in itself any differently, as far as its relationship to the individual human being is concerned, than about the known thing of the naive view of the world. Let me read that sentence again. For they do not think about the unknown thing in itself any differently, as far as its relation to the individual human being is concerned, than about the known thing of the naive view of reality. We avoid the confusion we fall into through critical reflection about this view only when we notice that there is something within what we can experience through perception in ourselves and outside in the world, something that cannot fall prey to the problems that arise when a mental picture interposes itself between the process and the observing human being. This something is thinking. In relation to thinking, a human being can remain with a naive view of reality. If we do not keep to this view, it is only because we notice that we have abandoned this viewpoint for another, but are unaware that the insight we have achieved is inapplicable to thinking. If we do become aware of this, then we allow ourselves entry into the other insight, that in thinking and through thinking, we must recognize that to which we apparently blinded ourselves by interposing our life of mental pictures between the world and ourselves. Someone highly esteemed by the author of this book has raised the objection that during his explication of thinking, the author maintains a naive realist view of thinking, as if the real world and the mentally pictured world were one and the same. Yet the author believes that he has proved by the present discussion that the validity of, quote, naive realism, unquote, for thinking follows necessarily from an unprejudiced observation of thinking, and that naive realism, which is invalid elsewhere, is overcome through knowledge of thinking's true essence.